Judiciary Committee for Monday, April 16, 2007. Thank you, committee members, for the strong attendance here on our first 8 a.m. meeting time. We're going to put the push the work session over until after the hearings have been held, and we will be taking the other public hearings in the order in which they're printed, except that the first bill, 2774, will be set over until Representative Shields, who's the chief sponsor, arrives. So we're going to first then open a public hearing on House Bill 2560. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. House Bill 2560 relates to the elements of felony driving under the influence of intoxicants, or DUI, in Oregon. ORS 813.010 establishes the elements for DUI law in Oregon. In short, most DUIs are Class A misdemeanors unless there's a serious injury to the victim. For a non-serious injury DUI to rise to the felony level, ORS 813.010 sub 5 requires that the person have three prior DUI convictions within 10 years prior to the date of the current offense. Since successful completion of the diversion program does not constitute a conviction, diversion does not count towards this number. House Bill 2560 changes the rules for felony DUIs in Oregon in the following two primary ways. First, it eliminates the in the 10 years prior language. Thus three lifetime prior DUIs would then be enough for felony DUI in Oregon on a subsequent conviction. Second, it effectively counts diversion from Oregon or any other state towards the total number of convictions if the diversion happened within the past 10 years.
Thank you, Council. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative, House District 28. We worked on this bill. We all believed in diversion, somebody having a drunk driving citation and getting a chance, and they, through the training and education, hopefully not to repeat it again. But it's the repeat drunk drivers that are really deadly on the roads. And so if you get a diversion, it doesn't count as a drunk driving. However, if you get a subsequent drunk driving conviction, then that first diversion will count as a drunk driving ticket because you obviously haven't learned the lesson that was intended there. And we just think that will be good and help save lives in Oregon. And that's the main purpose of the bill.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Barker? Okay. Thank you, Representative. Let's have Bruce Pratt and Ann Pratt.
Did you do this one last session?
No. We did the first.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Pratt, Crime Victims United. I'm here to in support of House Bill 2560 and thank Representative Barker very much for bringing this bill back. We are slowly changing the attitudes of the American public toward drinking and getting behind the wheel for a spin or to go home and sleep it off. Yet approximately 1.4 million people are arrested for intoxicated driving in America each year. An arrest rate of one in every 139 licensed drivers. Additionally, nearly 17,000 people are killed and about a half a million people are injured in alcohol-related crashes every year. Where is the outrage of these atrocious numbers? Most estimates indicate that people who have been previously convicted for drunk driving comprise about one-third of the drunk driving problem, and those previously arrested or convicted are 40% more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than those without prior DUI. This means that if the criminal justice system could somehow prevent these convicted drunk driving from recommitting the offense, we could save about 48 lives each year in Oregon and about 660 people from being injured. First-time offenders, not really first-time offenders, they have been shown to drive intoxicated or over the legal limit 87 times before their first arrest. Those so-called first offenders have an average blood alcohol content of 0.14. This is a very dangerous practice. I cannot stress the seriousness of the drunk driving situation any more than strongly than the previous facts state. Anyone with 4 drunk driving offenses in 10 years has shown a complete disregard of the lives of other motorists. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt.
Excuse me. Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of committee. I'm Ann Pratt, and I'm here with Crime Victims United. Crime Victims United fully supports House Bill 2560. I would like to tell you about a repeat DUI offender, a case pending in Multnomah County. This particular offender had 3 DUIs in 10 years and also had a 4th pending DUI at the time. We also know that under Oregon law that he would also been allowed a diversion program prior to the DUI, the 3 DUIs. This offender was on his way to his 4th DUI trial in Clackamas County during the morning commute when he careened into 2 other cars at 40 miles per hour, and there was no evidence that he tried to brake. The victims included a mother and her teenage daughter who were on the way to the daughter's school. Both sustained neck and back injuries. The third victim in another car was on his way to work. He sustained severe whiplash and other injuries. All victims were incapacitated for some time. Their vehicles were horribly wrecked. The offender could hardly stand up, much less drive. A search warrant was issued to obtain his blood. Soon after, he consented to a urine test, which showed multiple illegal drugs in his system. At the time of the crash, not only was the offender on his way to a trial, he was also currently on probation for 2 misdemeanor DUIs in Multnomah County. He has been charged with felony DUI, 2 counts of assault 3, reckless driving, reckless endangering times 2, misdemeanor driving while suspended, criminal mischief times 2. If House Bill 2560 were already law, we could have counted the diversion on his 3rd DUI. Convicted him of felony DUI, and this offender would have likely been incarcerated, and this crash wouldn't have happened. There would not have been any victims. There would not have been pain and suffering, the trauma, and the economic loss, which, by the way, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration calculates at $108,000 per DUI injury. We need House Bill 2560. Please pass House Bill 2560. Thank you for your time and attention. I would also like to point out that this case also relates to House Bill 2470 that you will also be hearing this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you very much for coming. We also have Ann Christian signed up.
Mr. Chair, my apologies. Ann Christian, for the record, I meant to sign up for 2740.
Ah, okay. So then we'll be probably going to another bill here.
Thank you.
First, before we go to that one, but thank you very much. So that's all the testimony that's signed up on House Bill 2560. So I'll close the public hearing on that bill, and we're going to go now to House Bill 2774.
Chip's bill. He just stepped outside.
He was here a moment.
They have a problem with it. They're going to work on it.
Okay, so let's. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill. Here he is.
You didn't say it.
I didn't say it. I'm ready for you.
I'm going to probably find this one.
Chair, for the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43 from North Northeast Portland. House Bill 2774 and its -1 amendment will modernize the state's ignition interlock statutes and will put Oregon at the forefront in using this technology to reduce drunk driving. Ignition interlocks are the devices that require one to blow into a valve in order to start one's car. And they generally require that the person's breath register little or no alcohol in order for the car to be started. I was pleased to work with Ann and Bruce Pratt and Steve Dole of Crime Victims United, as well as Mothers Against Drunk Driving, in bringing this bill forward. The original bill was a placeholder while we conducted our research on how best to update our ignition interlock statutes. Thanks to the work of the Pratts, MAD, and Judiciary Committee intern Miranda Plummer, we crafted the -2 amendments that are before you. -1 amendment that's before you, that essentially replaces the original bill. The Pratts received input from the Lane County District Attorney's Office and local judges. I received input from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, which is neutral on the bill. The amendments require two things. One, that a person use an ignition interlock device for 1 year after their driving privileges have been reinstated following their first conviction. 1 year of ignition interlock use for one conviction. Two, that a person use an ignition interlock device for 2 years after their driving privileges have been reinstated following their second conviction. 2 years of ignition interlock use for two convictions. The cost involved to the offender is approximately $70 for installation of the device, plus $70 per month, plus an occasional recalibration that costs $20. Now, the best thing about this bill, in my view, is that it places the cost squarely where it belongs, on the offender, not on the general public. Plus, it allows people to maintain the pro-social aspects of their life. For example, it will not interfere with one's ability to drive to work. This bill is still a work in progress, but we feel confident in the work that has been done on it to date. And, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask that you send it onto the floor with a due pass recommendation so that we can move it along to the Senate and continue work on it over there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Shields. Any questions? Thank you very much. Bruce Pratt.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt, again, as Crime Victims United, and I'm also a member of MAD. I'd like to thank Representative Shields for bringing this bill. My wife and I have campaigned for strengthened DUI legislation since the 2001 session. We have an opportunity today to save lives and prevent more people from becoming serious criminals in relation to driving under the influence of intoxicants. House Bill 2774 is a positive step in preventing unconscionable death rates from impaired driving. Fortunately, there is a technology that has the potential to reduce repeat drunk driving offenses, the breath alcohol ignition interlock. These devices can prevent a vehicle from being driven by a drunk driver. If they are correctly used in concert with treatment and a period of hard license suspensions and remain in the vehicles for a substantial period of time, they can significantly reduce repeat offenses. Current Oregon law administratively requires an ignition interlock device to be installed on any vehicle driven by a person convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants for the first 6 months after ending date of the suspension or revocation caused by a driving under the influence conviction, and as a condition before a hardship permit is granted. Courts are also permissively allowed to require IIDs to be installed as a requirement for driving while the offender is in a DUI diversion agreement after any suspension or revocation period, although according to DMV, this portion of the DUI statute is effectively not being used in Oregon. House Bill 2774 increases the time, as Representative Shields said, to 1 year for the first conviction, 2 years for the second and subsequent convictions. Provisions for court-ordered installation of the IID for offenders in a diversion agreement remains the same. An increase in the period of time for installation of an IID will accomplish at least two things. They will keep many people who have been convicted of DUI from driving intoxicated if they were required to drive only a car equipped with an IID, while also allowing the offender freedom to legally exercise the privilege of using the highways and be able to go to work, to school, and to treatment. This practice will give the offender more time to learn safe and sober driving practices. People have a previous drunk driving conviction make up approximately one-third of the drunk driving problem in America. These people, who have been failed by a system that has, in turn, failed to keep the rest of us safe. House Bill 2774, as amended, is a positive step in reducing repeat drunk driving in Oregon. Even first-time offenses are serious indicators that a person is likely to become a repeat offender. First-time offenders have been shown to have driven drunk 87 times before they are arrested, and most of likely have a serious problem with alcohol. They show very low recidivism rates within the IID program. Therefore, first-time offenders, including anyone in a diversion program, should be required to install the ignition interlock device. Ignition interlock devices are designed to record data as to failures caused by positive readings for blood alcohol in the offender or in tampering with the device. This data is supplied to the servicing company by the servicing company to the courts and or to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Most, if not all, of the available devices detect only methyl alcohol, the kind found in beer, wine, and spirits, thereby avoiding false positive readings from mouthwash or other products. They are accepted by offenders as a fair sanction that allows these offenders to drive legally after their hard suspension period is over and under a restricted license or hardship permit, and that they are found to be more successful in changing their drunk driving habits. Ignition interlock device has been shown to reduce recidivism by 50 to 90% by offenders while the device is installed. Restricted licensing with an ignition interlock device must be in conjunction with treatment programs and with monitoring as an essential part of the equation. Now, failure to successfully complete treatment or tampering with the device should restart the ignition interlock period. This bill does not cover that. This could be done within the court system in the case of diversion agreement or through DMP administratively. They also need to be mandatory for all offenders, as discretionary programs tend to have less than 10% usage. Additionally, while current long periods of hard suspension could be shortened and replaced by the longer restricted ignition interlock license, interlocks cannot replace a period of hard suspension. The innovative interlock law in New Mexico has proven very successful. Studies there have shown reduction in drunk driving related deaths of 12%. If we were to achieve both results here, that would mean 22 lives would be saved and 240 serious injuries would be avoided each year. I have highlighted some of the aspects of both Washington and New Mexico in my written statement. if we implement strong laws and run model programs such as New Mexico and Washington and some other states are now doing, we have the potential to curtail many repeat drunk driving offenses, and in doing so, to save many lives each year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, we just got the amendment, and I'll ask Mr. Pratt or Representative Shields may want to join in, because we've gone from a study to an implementation. Was that based upon a study, informal study, or how did we go from a study to implementation, Bill? And my colleague to the right here always tells me that her experience with young people, they find a way to get around things. And do we have any information on how easy it is to get around this? My third question is, we need to discuss the Intoxication Driver Program Fund. How is that funded? And what will be the criteria for people who do not have to pay for the installation? Sorry, that's about three questions.
You want to take a stab at them?
I'm going to take the second question first. As far as circumvention, there is a definite problem there. And that's one of the reasons I mentioned the shortening of the suspension or revocation period and replacing it with a longer period of the interlock device requirement. If I remember, it's 25% to 50% of the people who are required to have ignition interlocks refuse to get them. They wait the 6 months or they continue to drive. Now, that's driving while suspended, and that's a serious consequence as well. We would like everybody to go ahead and do the ignition interlock because it has a training aspect to it where they can learn to drive without the drinking.
As far as the study was concerned, the Pratts and I and Steve Dole, Crime Victims United, as well as the intern from the Judiciary Committee, and then eventually Legislative Council, have been meeting on this for a while. When the deadline came for submitting a bill, we hadn't had the full bill completely drafted and solidified, so we put this in as a placeholder with the notion that we'd come back. I apologize that we didn't get the amendments to you sooner. Representative Wisnett, I've been on the road with Ways and Means, and it just we're able to get that to you just on that short notice. But I did at least want you to know that it has been a thoughtful process, even though we didn't give you the notice perhaps that I would have liked to have done. On people's ability to get around it, I think that's a very valid concern. But I think it's also, it's like a lot of white-collar crime. When there's collusion, it's almost impossible to keep a fraudulent crime from happening. I think it's similar in this case. And you also have to think of what person in their right mind, if they were sober, would blow into a machine so that the drunk person could drive. I'm sure it could happen, particularly with young people, but I think it would take what we're trying to do is to set up barriers for people driving drunk, and I think the fact that they would need to collude would be one of those barriers. And then regarding the funding, there is an indigent fund for this kind of thing for other court requirements, and I'm not absolutely certain of the mechanics. Perhaps Ann Christian or someone from the district attorney's office or perhaps counsel might have some insight into the mechanics of that. I'm not an expert.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett. The indigence is based on the food stamp program, federal food stamp program, and there is also methods where the court can decide on a payment schedule or a reduced fee, and some of the funds can come from the drink and driver program or the funding.
Representative Flores, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am aware of the Washington, or a little bit experience with the Washington program. How long have they had their program, and did you look to them for lessons learned so we don't create mistakes they've made in this legislation, which is not finished, I guess. The legislation is not finished based upon Mr. Pratt's comments.
The Chair McPherson, representative, was not. The original bill in Washington was installed in 1994. I'm not sure on that. And it was upgraded again about 2 years later. I don't know what experience they've had. I can't answer that.
And if I could just add that Miranda Plummer had gone to NCSL and had done significant research into what other states were doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Shields and Mr. Pratt. I'm interested in the process for the ignition interlock device. I've heard a company makes this device available. Person has to go to said company to have installed. The second paragraph of your written testimony, Mr. Pratt, you talk about asking for a rolling retest at a preset interval. I'd like some more information on that. Any failures as well as any tampering are recorded and reported to the servicing agent. I presume that to be the company. And then the agent reports to the Department of Motor Vehicles. So is this like an ongoing, a person, once they're kind of plugged into this mechanism, they're recorded somewhere, the big control panel in the sky, or how does that work?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, first of all, the companies, there are approximately eight companies that are offering the service here in Oregon, and innumerable outlets, and they're expanding all the time. That is a problem in the outreaches of Oregon. There may not be interlock devices available, so they have to have some flexibility. The courts have to have some flexibility. Now, I don't know what DMV is going to do there. And as far as the rolling test, first of all, the instrument installed in the car only interrupts the starting mechanism. It does not shut the car down. If they get the car started, they haven't been drinking, they go on their way, and they have a rolling retest, it gives an indication that they need to retest. And it's indicated from my research that they have time to pull over to the side of the road so they can do the retest in a safe manner. If they fail to do the retest in a timely manner, or if they have a bottle in the car, then the instrument records a failure. And it does not shut the car down. It causes the car to either sound the horn or flash the light so that police can, law enforcement can inspect it and see what's going on here. Does that answer your question?
It begins to.
Okay.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Is there some information that as you were looking at this particular bill and this mechanism that you could provide to us about the process, or is that something that we can research, and if so, where would you send us?
I have, Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I have several pieces of information with me and that I could have copied and supply it to you all, and so it can answer a lot of your questions. There is a pamphlet that has question and answer pages in it, and has some information about the different companies. Would that be helpful?
Thank you. And yes, it would be helpful and informational. And Mr. Chair, just one little further piece. And the tampering and the recording and the reporting, that's all done on an internal unit, is it, within the car? And is someone then seeing that at a given point in time, or is it something that's kind of taken out, delivered, and looked at and evaluated? I'm just kind of trying to get the wrap
Chairman
on this.
Chairman McPherson, thank you for the question. Representative Floss, I'm failed to answer that portion. The instruments are installed in local areas. For instance, Circuit City is one installer for the instruments, and so the person goes down with their car and has it installed, and then I'm going to interject here that notice by the installer is sent to either DMV or the courts, whichever is required. Then every 2 months, as a rule, the person has to go back to the installer and have it calibrated, is what they call. And that is reading the information, how many starts, how many failures, any tampering is recorded on the instrument and is read either two ways, read at the installation point, or there's one company that actually pulls the unit out and installs a new one. Now, if the installer reads the instrument, they make sure it's recalibrated and running properly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, and then I presume it, when they read that it has been tampered with, they're instructed to let the proper authorities know.
Thank you.
Representative Lucent.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I have a constituent. They lost their license to drive forever because our law is 3 DUIs and you lose it forever, right?
That's
am I correct?
Mr. Chair, so, that's correct.
So this bill, we talk about New Mexico, a person after, you know, they're talking third conviction and the rest of their life. If, you know, are we looking at saying, you know, we're going to change our law about losing your license forever if you use one of these devices? Is that the intent? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we looked at trying to, you know, have 3 years, 3 years of using this device for your third conviction, but then we realized, of course, that you're not allowed to legally drive after your third conviction. So, no, this wouldn't affect that at all. This would just ramp it up for the first and second convictions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I might add that if this could be, if this offender could be proven to obey the laws and to use the ignition interlock, that is a very real possibility. We have to remember that that person, not necessarily your person, but that person who loses his license for a lifetime may not be obeying the law. They may still be driving a car. They may go out and get the $200 junker and drive it till the license is gone and then get another one. So if we could get that person to be able to legally drive and obey the law and not drink and drive, then that's a very real and good possibility.
Thank you. I have a question for Representative Shields. This is an expansion of an existing program. So there's already a six-month period after a DUI conviction. And so there must be a body of experience then about how reliably people are actually complying with this requirement, how effective the equipment is. What have you drawn on that history in developing this expansion?
Mr. Chair, the Pratts have done a fair amount of research in their local county. They've talked to the Lane County District Attorney as well as judges to get a sense that that of how it's working. As far as any intense studies here in Oregon, I have not seen any indication of that.
Okay. Representative Common.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Just a quick question. We were told at the beginning of this that the installation cost is $70, and then there'd be a $70 per month charge?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Where does that $70 per month go? And my only comment is, that's a lot of money for every month.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, you're correct. It is a lot of money, and I think it would be similar to a lot of the criminal fines and assessment fees that we weigh on a lot of different different cases. Where the money goes is to the companies who operate these devices.
Okay, follow up, Chair. So if you have an indigent person that can't pay for it, I'm concerned that there will be money having to come out of an account or something happens there.
Representative Kump, if you look at page 2 of the bill, lines 15 to 21, it discusses the the waive and deferring of these kinds of costs. And it would be similar to indigent funds for other offenses. My understanding is that that counties could decide to also charge a little bit more to those who actually could afford to pay so that the fee could be waived for those who could not.
Thank you.
Committee, I suggest we've got a couple more people signed up that we excuse these witnesses and then kind of learn a little bit more from another perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Christian signed up.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I'm testifying, I signed up, Mr. Chair, as neutral. Actually, OCDLA is in support of House Bill 2774 with the Dash 1 amendments. And I want to thank Representative Shields for consulting with our organization on this. And we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Shields and Mr. and Mrs. Pratt on this matter. I think this is an example. The ignition interlock is a good example of OCDLA's good faith support of mechanisms that help people with their recovery and help them to refrain from getting behind the wheel, having had consumed alcohol. And I'm pleased to hear the notion that perhaps at some point in time, perhaps after some additional study, Mr. Chair, that you suggest there should be out there, that at some point in time we can pursue the notion perhaps of individuals having, provided they're complying with their treatment and their probation, having the opportunity to have perhaps shorter suspensions but with longer periods of time with the ignition interlock device. To address some of the questions with regard to $70 per month is a lot of money, especially for many individuals who are charged with DUII. That was one of OCDLA's concerns and actually the only concern we had with this bill with the amendment. And as Representative Shields pointed out, existing law does provide a mechanism for individuals who do not have sufficient resources to pay $70 per month. And that's with the Department of Administrative Services making a determination, again, as was said, based on food stamps and their eligibility guidelines that the person should have all or part of that fee waived. And so with that provision, OCDLA actually is in support of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Christian. Any questions? Then Mary
you.
Stewart. Ms. Stewart.
Chair McPherson, Vice Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Mary Stewart, the Executive Director for Mothers Against Driving, Drunk Driving, based out of the Portland area. And you've already received quite a bit of good information in regards to these devices, so I really just want to add to that. Mothers Against Drunk Driving is very much in favor of the amendment or to the law as amended. We have a campaign to eliminate drunk driving nationally. It's a 4-point solution to drunk driving. One of those solutions is the use of technology and the continued support of new technology. So, of course, interlock devices fall in that category. And I do have some good news for you that I don't think has been brought up. When it comes to these devices, they have been greatly improved over the past year or two, and they continue to improve. So one of the things that might be helpful for you to know is that now, for example, it's much more difficult to falsify a breath because as the device is installed, the device learns the offender's breath, if you will, and then it will identify if it's a different person that is blowing into the device, and it will not let the car start. There are other things where you blow once, but then a little ways down the road you have to blow again. So they're getting better and better. So this whole idea of using technology to prevent drunk driving, we want to really, really encourage you to do this. Let's see, something else I think that was brought up or was questioned was about the installers. There are many different companies, different installers all over the state, every part of the state, where offenders can actually go to get this installed, and many of the companies have mobile installers that actually come to the folks. So I think that they make it as easy as possible, you know, to actually get the units. In Oregon, about one in every six offenders are currently getting the units installed, just so you know. And that actually is a little bit better than the national average, so good for Oregon. But it would be nice if everybody could do that. I heard New Mexico mentioned, and there has the study of how well their bill did for the use of interlock devices. Is within the first year there was an 18% decrease in drunk driving deaths. So to us, that's pretty powerful evidence. And the idea of all offenders using the devices is perhaps a very smart idea. I also heard the concern mentioned about how the affordability of this. And, you know, I think there are probably options, but also I think we want to say, well, you know, if people can afford, you know, the gas, you know, the cost to drive and that sort of thing, you know, maybe they drive a little bit less, but they should be able to afford this as well. And someone jokingly said, well, perhaps the lower alcohol cost in their budget, you know, they can they can make up the difference. So, yeah, I guess I would encourage you to think about ways that there might be some options for that. I think the bottom line is that the devices save lives, and I think that's what we want to really dwell on, because in Oregon there's still way too many people dying from drunk driving, about 200 last year, 6,000 injured by drunk drivers. So that's a significant amount that cost us way too high on. Mothers Against Drunk Driving does have a white paper that we have prepared on this particular device. I'd be happy to supply that if that would be helpful to you. Chair McPherson, be happy to, if you don't already have that.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. I think what we're getting on to late in the process here, and so we have to come to decisions quickly. In fact,
okay.
I'm going to be putting that question to the committee here shortly. So
okay.
For the moment, I think we won't invite more information.
All right. Is there anything else that I might do?
No, I think that's fine.
Okay.
Representative Cameron has a question, though.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick question, Ms. Stewart. You mentioned the technology being able to recognize breath, and I've been sitting over here thinking about families with multiple cars, multiple drivers. How does that take place if a family has one car and multiple drivers? And then the other thing is, if family has multiple cars, are they installed on all the cars that are registered to the individual in the family?
Well, if I understand it correctly, the person should be, it should be installed on any car the person would be driving. sorry. I should have said.
Thank you. That
Chair McPherson, Representative
Cameron. Answers that question, if I may follow up. Then what about the multi-driver of one car? If it's recognizing my breath, my wife gets in, she's going to have to blow? And is it a dual technology, for example, when she drives it?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm not aware that it has that sophistication.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick, and the people putting together this rewrite or the amendments, because that's, I support the idea, but we haven't seen the details. There's a lot of details out there. Because I think one of the things I'd want to see is if someone blows in for someone else to drive, that should be a crime of significant proportion, that they lose their license or the same thing, something. So there's a lot of the details like that we haven't seen yet in the amendments. So.
Okay. Those are all the questions. Thank you, Ms. Stewart.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Those are all the witnesses signed up. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2774, and because we're late in the process, I want to open it for discussion committee, open a work session on House Bill 2774, and I realize that we have a set of Dash 1 amendments that are just came to us today on a program that exists already.
But Mr. Chair, it's not just that. We've been told that there are going to be more amendments
there,
coming.
There are, in fact, and so we've been passed what the those amendments would do, and so, Council, why don't you explain what the proposed amendments are?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, Mr. Pratt handed me a copy of the proposed amendments, and if you look at the Dash 1 amendments, look at page 3. And what I'm refer your attention to lines 4 and line 7 on page 3. I'll read starting at line 1. If the suspension is for failing to submit proof of installation, the suspension continues until the department receives proof that the ignition interlock device has been installed, or until 6 months after the ending date of the suspension resulting from the conviction, whichever comes first. The suspension language there in line 4, what the proposed amendment would do is change that, get rid of the suspension and change that to of the required installation. And then the same thing in line 7, eliminate the language of the suspension, replace of the suspension with of the required installation. And my just a quick thought on that, it appears to be that it wouldn't make sense to the idea that the person hasn't installed something to time the suspension. The clock for the suspension should start once the installation requisite installation begins, rather than what the person hasn't been doing, what they're supposed to be doing in the past. If that makes sense. So that's my understanding. I could be corrected, but that is the dash. That would be the supposed Dash 2 amendment, and that's it. No one has told me anything about any other type of amendment that's required on this.
Well, I think that, Mr. Chair, they mentioned, Mr. Pratt did, that there need to be penalties for tampering with the devices.
Representative Wisner, that would go beyond the scope of what this bill does, and the further changes, policy changes, could be made either in this or a separate vehicle, but I think that this choices made in this bill, which is to extend the period of time in which ignition interlock devices are required, would it stands on its own. So, committee, we have a situation where we have a Dash 1 amendment we just came into possession of today, since we're getting it kind of and it is quite a change from where the original bill went. But we're all and we're getting late in this session. Particularly late in the period of time in which we have to consider House bills, which is just for the next 2 weeks. So we could have several choices. One is to not move this bill today and invite the revised amendment and bring it back another time. We're getting a very crowded agenda, so it's going to be harder to get that scheduled and may take some more meeting time. And we may perish the thought to be looking at some evening meeting time in order to get our work done. We could do a conceptual amendment of the one that was just presented to us. Or we could move the bill as it is, recognizing that this is the first chamber and that revision could be made in the Senate. It could come back for concurrence, assuming that it passes through the process and comes back. So those are the range of choices, and I opened the work session so I could get a sense of the committee's comfort
with any one of those options. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, noticing that there is some fee waiver and deferral language in here, and that has an impact on the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, et cetera, is there a subsequent referral on this?
There is not a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill.
I note on the staff measure summary that it indicates it may have a fiscal impact, but I don't see any information in that regard.
Okay. Representative Flores, that is, if I had received nothing from fiscal at all, that's the language that I put in there. So it's not indicating that, oh, there very well could be. It's just I don't have any idea is what the may have a fiscal impact means. So,
At what point then would that be determined?
When it's a strange chicken and egg problem with getting stuff from fiscal. They start looking at doing the analyses when we have work sessions scheduled, which is odd because you would want to know the fiscal information before you decide what to do with it.
Right.
So that's as good as I can answer that question.
And I would note that the concept of this whole structure, which is already in the law, is that the cost of maintaining this system is borne generally by the driver as a condition for the privilege of driving. And that this bill here doesn't create that system. It simply expands it from the existing 6 months to either 1 year or 2 years, depending on what the prior violation history is. So it's not as though we're creating something that doesn't exist in the law now. It already exists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly appreciate that, and I do realize that, although we're talking about a whole host of people that could possibly be eligible to receive deferrals and waivers because we're expanding the pool. Please do not misunderstand. I'm very supportive of the concept here. I just feel a little lacking of information on the methodology, and then that fiscal issue causes me a little interest along the way.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Council could remind us where the funds come from for the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund.
Representative Bonamici, off the top of my head, no, but I'm good at deferring to a couple of nodding heads in the audience that can answer that question. Ms. Christian or Ms. Ryerson, either one of you?
Hopefully we get the same answer. Mr. Chair, Ann Christian from Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. My memory is that fund is funded by a specified fee for people who participate in the DUI diversion program.
That's my guess. So,
So we have a range of options. Representative Comp, do you have a thought?
Well, just to share my preference, Chair, many times we've been very thorough with our original process here when we do a public hearing. My preference would be to get the amendments here so we can see exactly what it is and reschedule it.
Okay. And that works fine. I recognize we'll be more meeting time involved, but that is a responsible way.
But I'm just one voice.
Okay.
You could do it at a dinner meeting.
Well, I'll tell you, the dinner meetings that Krieger organizes are first rate.
And Mr. Chair, I certainly appreciate your reminders that we're getting late in the process, but I think that we have the responsibility to do our due diligence when we're talking about good public policy as well, and not forsake it for a time limitation.
Hearing those comments and not hearing a motion, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that's fine with me as long as we can have some assurance that this will get back on the agenda, because I think this is
one of those great
opportunities where we're actually looking at preventing rather than treating after the fact. And if we can prevent some DUIs with this, then we need to pass it. So if there's any chance that it's not going to get back on the agenda, I'd be willing to do the consensus amendment and move it forward. So What's your thought on that?
I would join with that.
I think we all want to see it passed. I don't think that's the question again.
With the staff we've got, no problem.
It sounds like we're the preference, the weight of view is to bring it back and a willingness to work whatever hours it takes to look at that amendment to get it moved. That's what I'm hearing from the committee. Okay, I will then close the work session on House Bill 2774 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2740. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2740 relates to the creation of the crime of aggravated vehicular homicide, Class A felony. ORS 163.005 defines criminal homicide as when, without justification or excuse, a person intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence causes the death of another human being. By definition, this term includes murder, manslaughter, or then criminally negligent homicide. House Bill 2740 expands the definition of criminal homicide to include, quote, aggravated vehicular homicide, close quote. This aggravated vehicular homicide occurs when a person, acting with criminal negligence, operates a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants, and this results in the death of another person, and the driver has either, one, a previous conviction for driving under the influence, or DUI, that resulted in death or serious physical injury of another person, or two, any of the following convictions in Oregon or other states in which the underlying cause of death or serious injury was the defendant's driving. Manslaughter, first or second degree, criminally negligent homicide, or assault, first, second, or third degree. House Bill 2740 also amends the crime of first degree assault, ORS 163.185, to include circumstances when a person intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence causes serious physical injury to another while operating a motor vehicle under the influence, if the person has either, one, three prior DUIs, two, a previous DUI that resulted in death or serious injury, or three, any of the following convictions in Oregon or in other states in which the underlying cause of death or serious injury was the defendant's driving, manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, or assault. There are also additional provisions in House Bill 2740 to bring aggravated vehicular homicide in line with statutes pertaining to seizure and forfeiture of vehicles involved in the offense and criminal driving while suspended or revoked. House Bill 2740 specifies that 15, 16, or 17-year-old defendants who commit aggravated vehicular homicide are tried in adult criminal court and not juvenile court, and it sets the presumptive sentence for aggravated vehicular homicide at 240 months. There is a -1 amendment, which I actually have not seen, which we received this morning. My understanding of the amendment is that it relates to prior convictions of a person. If a person has any prior convictions where there were accidents relating to driving as a whole is what the -1 amendment does, not just intoxicated driving. I will stand to be corrected if that's not what the -1 amendment does.
Representative Barker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have not seen the -1 amendment, so what this bill tries to do is get the person who just simply doesn't care, who's already seriously injured or killed somebody, or keeps driving drunk, and then they drive and kill somebody, they're going to go away for a long time. And hopefully, if people have these prior convictions, they'll realize if they're driving the car and something happens, the seriousness of the penalty, and that will deter them from driving the car. And that's the real objective, is to keep them from doing it. However, if they simply don't care and they go ahead and do it again, kill somebody, then they're going to be locked up for 20 years.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
I'd looked at the bill. I'm signing on to the bill, I believe. It specifies that a 15, 16, or 17-year-old could be tried in adult court. No problem with that in my mind. I have a little bit of concern about a 16-year-old going to jail for 20 years on the... But you're saying that there's got to be
prior
offenses. And then, I don't know if you can address it, if you thought about it, a $375,000 fine, I don't know how many juveniles are capable of addressing that if it was imposed, and what would be the, maybe the staff can tell us what happens if they don't pay that judgment. They're kind of starting out in the hole as far as getting education, having a family. It's not saying that that's wrong, but maybe is that justice necessary? You want to make sure the victim is compensated. I understand that, but we're trying to find a balance. There's a little concern I have.
Well, thank you, Representative. I don't believe the courts would have to put that fine on.
They could be looking. They could be looking at ability to pay.
Right. And again, this is somebody who's already essentially what it was aimed at was somebody who's already killed or really seriously injured somebody, and then they go out and do it again, and there's a death result this next time. And we've seen cases like that where it's somebody who just simply doesn't care, and they need to be. We need to get them out of circulation. They're, they caused that death, which is horrific.
Okay. There are no further questions. Thank you, Representative Barker.
Thank you.
We have other bills set on the agenda, and so we need to move this process along. And so I'm going to have to be time limiting people for here from this point on, because I want to get to that other bill by. I'd hoped by a quarter past, but certainly by 20 past, I want to be able to be there. So let's bring a panel up together of Steve Dole, Ann Pratt, and Jane Furlich.
Committee. My name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'll make my comments brief so that we can have Jane Furlich, who's here with us today, tell you about a specific of why we need this bill. This bill is a bill that has come to you for a second time from last session. If you'll remember, and I don't mean to dwell on this, but it got caught up in the politics and procedure at the end of this last session. It was passed 54-4 by the House, and then was passed 29-1 by the Senate, and was left at the door, if you will, or at the gates at the end of the session, last session, and did not make it into law. But we're here again today. We won't dwell on the past. This is a very narrowly drawn bill that's specifically targeted to repeat offenders who kill and maim with their automobiles while driving drunk. I did hear the concerns of Representative Krieger. Quite frankly, you're not going to have first of all, you're not supposed to be driving when you're 15, or at least with a license. 16 and 17-year-olds, you probably wouldn't have one fall under this law. In other words, the law is there more as a matter of the record. So if a 17-year-old does kill or maim someone when they're 17, that later in life, if they do it again, this bill would apply to them. But I don't think you'd have it applying under the 20-year limit or the 7.5-year limit. I want to thank Representative Barker for his sponsorship, and also Representative Krieger, Flores, Comp, and Wisnett for signing on to the bill. And as I said, I'd make my comments brief and turn it over to Ann Pratt. Thank you.
Again, good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. I'm Ann Pratt from Crime Victims United, and I will also try and be brief. House Bill 2740 addresses Oregon's worst DUI offenders. These are the hardcore repeat offenders that kill while under the influence of intoxicants, and these are not social drinkers. They know the catastrophic consequences of driving intoxicated. And in addition, each time when they receive a DUI, they are evaluated, sent to treatment, and are nearly always ordered to sit in on a victim impact panel where victims tell their stories of death and loss and destruction that an intoxicated driver has caused on their lives. They listen to the giant ripple effect of one single act that has had on many lives. These offenders knowingly continue to disregard the law, continue driving intoxicated, and leave the rest of us at risk. They are truly an accident, or should say rather a homicide or assault waiting to happen. In a moment, you will hear from Jane Furlich, who I'd like to reserve much time for. But I want to tell you briefly about two others. One happened in two.
Ms. Pratt, we're at limited time, so if you wanted to reserve significant time for Ms. Furlich, we probably ought to go to her. So maybe if you could summarize what you
okay. A case in Linn County that happened where an intoxicated driver on his seventh Dewey killed a 17-year-old passenger, and the other one was John Patrick Bush, who killed two people 9 years apart in Jackson County, is also summarized on my testimony along with other states and comments from victims. I will stop here and turn it over to Jane Furlich, who will tell her story of what happened to her family. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Ms. Furlich.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Jane Furlich, and I live in Washington County, and I'm a member of Crime Victims United. On September 11, 2001, America was hit by terrorists. People were grief-stricken and scared, wondering who would be the next target. No one could believe what had happened and why it had happened. It seemed so senseless and random. Even years afterward, people still talk about the great events of that day. It changed their lives forever. We know what those feelings are. We understand those because we were attacked 2 years ago by a terrorist. This terrorist didn't care what innocent lives were lost because of his actions. This terrorist had killed before, and unless something was done, he would kill again. He is not alone in his actions. He is a person who drives while intoxicated. Early in the morning on July 18, 1999, James Lincoln Willie stole his friend's methadone, mixed it with Valium, Klonopin, Depakote, Buspar, Imipramine, and Perphenazine, and drove his Ford Econoline van over the center line of Highway 26, not once, but several times on a clear, sunny Sunday. First, he did a hit and run in Astoria, then almost hit a school bus full of high school athletes, and then came over the center line toward the Honda Accord driven by my father-in-law, Martin Furlich. Martin pulled over to the right and slammed on the brakes, but the van hit him head-on, killing him instantly. My mother-in-law, Angela Furlich, heard a roaring noise, looked at Martin, and saw the steering wheel impaled into his chest, and knew her husband of 43 years was gone. Quickly, she looked to the back seat where her granddaughter Jennifer had been sitting. 12-year-old Jennifer was slumped over, turning blue. The next thing Angela remembers is someone screaming. She didn't realize the screaming was coming from her own mouth. It's been almost 8 years since we entered this nightmare. How many times have we awoken screaming? How many times have we broken down crying? How many times have we asked, why us? How many times have we asked, why was he even on the road? James Willie had killed his wife and best friend while driving drunk in 1977. He was convicted of criminally negligent homicide and received a sentence of 5 years. He only served 2 years and 4 months.
Excuse me, Ms. Furlich, I'm very sorry to do this, but we have your written testimony, and so we have all the text that you've prepared. Perhaps you could summarize the remainder of it here orally for us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Our family, how we have been affected by this tragedy is that none of us is ever the same. My mother-in-law cries constantly. It's been 8 years. She's very anxious. She had two back surgeries last year as a result of her injuries sustained in the crash. We've all had a lot of stress problems, all because one man had no regard. This guy had a rap sheet, you know, 8 feet long, and has been in for assault, other DUIs. His license was revoked 6 times in Oregon, and I didn't even put in how many times it was revoked in Texas, where he previously lived. So he is a very bad repeat offender. He basically killed our family. When he killed my father-in-law and my niece.
Thank you, Ms. Furlich. We're very sorry for your loss, and we appreciate your coming in to present to us today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also I want to just state this. The chiefs of police and the sheriffs are also in support of this bill, as are the DAs, and we have Susan Howard from the DAs Association here to address
She's signed up next. So,
yeah, the amendments on the bill. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's have Susan Howard.
Good morning. Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Susan Howard. I'm with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm a district attorney in that office. I've been a district attorney for almost 7 years now. I'm specifically assigned to a unit that prosecutes vehicular homicide and vehicular serious assaults. So this is something that I do on a daily basis. First, what I'd like to talk about is the amendments to House Bill 2740. -1, that it's my understanding that you don't have a copy of that. Is that correct? Okay. Let me talk about what the amendments that we would propose are. Under Section 1, where it says criminal homicide constitutes aggravated vehicular homicide when it is committed with criminal negligence, we would like to add the mental states of recklessly and with recklessly with extreme indifference to the value of human life and recklessly. The reason for that is that we can't be confident that a court would be able to read in a higher mental state in that particular section, and it could result in totally disparate results, whereas somebody that does something recklessly could be convicted of a lesser offense and receive a much smaller sentence. So we need to add those two mental states. Additionally, under subsection A, driving under the influence of intoxicants that resulted in the death or serious physical injury of another person, we need to strike that entirely. And the reason is that we do have cases where people are DUII, a death results from that, but it's not the fault or the cause of the DUII. For instance, we have a case where a person is DUII, they're at a stop sign, they're not even driving anywhere at this point. And we have a case right now where someone's driving a bicycle and runs smack into the car. A death resulted. There was a DUII, but it wasn't the cause. The DUII was not the cause of the death. And so that's why we need to strike that paragraph, the subsection A. Subsection B, we would ask that you take out the language at the back end of it that says was the result of the defendant's state of intoxication while driving. The reason for that is if we had to prove that each prior, let's say, manslaughter in the first degree was the result of the defendant's state of intoxication while driving, we would have to go back and prove that that was the only result or that was the only reason for the death. And in many cases, it's more than just the alcohol use. It's maybe there was speed involved. There were multiple factors. And so that language needs to be taken out. What we have proposed that it states is that any of the following crimes or their statutory counterparts in any jurisdiction, if the victim's death or serious physical injury was simply caused by defendant driving a motor vehicle. So we do have the manslaughter cases that don't involve under the influence of intoxicants, where it's simply driving incredibly recklessly. Maybe they're on the cell phone. Maybe they're, you know, doing something else in the car at the time. So we'd ask that you strike that language and put in.
Ms. Howard,
sure.
We're really through all the time that I'd hoped to allot for this bill in order to allow us to complete our agenda. Since we have there are amendments being proposed that we don't have in front of us, rather than walking us through changes that we can't look at, and since we aren't in a position then to move the bill today, perhaps we ought to close this out at this point. And then, but do recognize we've got a very limited time for us to take action here on House bills, so do act quickly to prepare those.
The one thing that I do want to mention is that before I close is that one of the reasons we've also added the three prior DUII convictions to the aggravated vehicular homicide as well as the assault one. And the reason for that is if you just added it to the assault one, you could have people getting a higher sentence who committed basically an assault in the third degree, whereas somebody who actually kills someone with a criminal negligent homicide could end up with potentially probation. And so that's what we have to, it's a proportionality argument. We have to have it on both.
Very good.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Howard.
Thank you.
We have one more witness signed up, Mary Stewart.
And Ms. Stewart, if you could come forward, but recognize just very briefly, because we know about the organization and the wonderful work you do and dealing with the drunk driving issues. So
thank you, Chair McPherson. I'll make it very brief. Mothers of Drunk Driving is in support of this bill, encourages you to pass, because it's just entirely too risky to the roadways and the folks on them if we don't do that. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Ms. Christian, I just learned that you had signed up as well, though it didn't get on the list I had, so if you could, again, very briefly.
And, Mr. Chair, for the record, Ann Christian with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I had four issues I was going to discuss, and the largest one was proportionality, and Ms. Howard has addressed that, apparently, in the Dash 1 amendments, which I would like to look at. And the other three, I simply would appreciate an opportunity to perhaps meet with Ms. Howard and other interested people so that we can try to discuss what would be the final form of this bill, because OCDLA did have considerable concerns about the wording that now in the Dash 1 is being removed, and also the proportionality issues with regard to a 20-year sentence.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Christian.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2740 and open a public hearing together on two bills, House Bills 3251 and 3369, and invite Representative Nathanson. And I think you have... Council Taylor gives a little
introduction. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3369 and House Bill 3251 come from Representative Nathanson. House Bill 3369 requires a county that has a local public safety coordinating council to publish annual report describing the state of the local criminal justice system, including an explanation of administrative actions, budgetary activities, etc. Requires a report to be provided to the Department of Corrections. Requires the county to fill a vacancy in its public safety coordinating council within the early of 3 months after the vacancy becomes vacant or within 3 months after receiving notice. Requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to add to its comprehensive long-range plan for coordinating state criminal justice system the effective utilization of local public safety coordinating councils. House Bill 3251 requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to administer a grant program, authorizes grants up to $100,000, appropriates the amount of $1 million to the Commission for grants, has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, hello. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative for House District 13. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for opening the hearing on both bills simultaneously. It will save some time because some of my comments really relate to both, so I only have to do it once. Local public safety coordinating councils have been working since 1997 to help better organize our local public safety systems. I had the privilege of serving on my local PSCC in Lane County to observe and to participate firsthand in the benefits of collaborative work, interagency discussion, and cross-pollination. As a state representative, I would like to help the local councils, or LIPSICs, achieve greater potential. Collaboration, such as the kind that LIPSICs enable, can lead to improved service and cost-effective solutions, all to the common goal of improving public safety in Oregon communities. Collaboration can spur creative ideas for joint projects and new ways of doing business. In this building, we often call on collaboration as a way to squeeze more out of less and to get even better results with resources that can't keep pace with increasing demands. Public safety is the third largest expense for the state, behind education and human services. In the criminal justice system, there are separate jurisdictions at different levels of government with parallel and overlapping responsibilities, and the activities of each can directly impact the work or results of the other. County sheriffs and jails, city police, parole and probation, district attorneys, judges, and public defenders. But casting an even wider net, it goes to youth advocates, mental health providers, elected officials, appointed officials, advisory groups, and nonprofit community organizations. This network could function with fantastic results designed as a criminal justice system, but it can also be simply a tangled labyrinth. Without coordination, agencies can develop programs that are unrelated and at cross purposes, and sometimes competing for public money and community donations. Lawmakers thought it was important to get the criminal justice system components working together better, so important that in the 1970s, the legislature codified this principle as a directive, ORS 423.560. That statute set up the public safety coordinating councils. LPSCs were established with the task of helping to organize and coordinate activities and policy among criminal justice entities and to provide recommendations for more efficient and effective use of public safety resources. The law provides instructions for who should be at the table, but little other administrative or organizational demands or advice. It also says that the LPSCs shall, at a minimum, develop and recommend to the County Board of Commissioners a plan for the use of state resources to serve the local offender population, and goes on to provide a little bit more specific direction with regard to youth offenders. The legislature has mandated these entities into existence, the LPSCs, yet unlike other coordinating groups, such as watershed councils or commissions on children and families, LPSCs operate without state resources specifically to help accomplish the task. LPSCs have been meeting. They've been brainstorming. And in times, they've been reinventing systems. Good things are happening, but not necessarily uniformly around the state. Sometimes it's just too darned hard to make it happen. You know how it is. Sometimes there's a lack of resources or time to set aside time to just sit down with your counterparts and think. But that time and that collaboration is an essential investment in the future. The statute enabling the Public Safety Coordinating Councils is a mandate for continuous improvement. It's a terrific idea. LPSCs can help make things happen that wouldn't otherwise. These two bills provide a little more instruction and a little nudge where LPSCs are stalled and provide the hope for some help. I consulted with public agency staff, local elected officials, and Criminal Justice Commission representatives. The concepts outlined in these bills benefited from their advice, observations, and suggestions. 3251. The state does not currently provide financial support specifically targeted to LPSCs or to assist with the collaborative projects they may develop. Another statute does instruct the Criminal Justice Commission to provide technical assistance to LPSCs. This bill would create an incentive fund to promote collaboration by providing grants. Individual grants would not exceed $100,000, and the total of all grants is limited to $1 million. Four examples of how I envision the grant money might be used, depending on how the process is defined. In a low-population county with constrained resources, it might fund a part-time staff person to coordinate the council, assisting with scheduling and convening meetings, gathering, researching, and sharing information at the direction of the council. In an active council poised to restructure the court system, for example, setting up treatment courts, it might fund the startup costs. In an active county researching service needs or effectiveness of programs, it might fund a data collection and analysis project. In a county ready to invest in a shared criminal justice building housing multiple agencies and programs, it might fund a feasibility study or site study to help get the project off the ground. And then briefly to the other bill, 3369. From my observed experience and from consulting with several staff knowledgeable about these councils, it seems that it's possible that from time to time they lapse into a dormant state, not meeting, and vacancies can go unfilled for some time. Sometimes there are ideas, but little follow through. These councils are instructed to make reports to boards of county commissioners, but the LPSC members or citizens can wonder whatever became of those ideas, whatever became of fill in the blank. To provide more transparency in government and to close the loop, this bill would indicate that it's good for the public to know what became of those recommendations. A simple letter of report would provide that follow-up. So this bill has three objectives: to help them operate at full strength, to close the loop and report back, and to report back to the legislature. The criminal justice system already makes a regular report to the legislature. This merely adds that a description of the work of the LPSCs will provide information to track implementation and effectiveness of the law that already exists and provide recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Judge? Mr. Chair, Judge Marianne Bearden has also come today.
Very good. Judge?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Marianne Bearden. I'm the presiding judge in Lane County Circuit Court, and I'm here in support of 3251 and 3369. I just want to add a few brief remarks to what Representative Nathanson has said. In Lane County, we've had a very active public safety coordinating committee at local, and as part of the process that we undertook over the last few years, we have done what we call report cards, which are very much like the annual reports that are being envisioned here, but ours are I think considerably more comprehensive than what would be required of all counties. It has been a very useful exercise. I can't tell you how much collaboration has come in Lane County as a result of our regular meetings of our local public safety coordinating council, but I can tell you they are very considerable. We have unprecedented levels of cooperation, information sharing, and coordination of services in the public safety arena in Lane County. I think that it's largely because of the PSCC, our local PSCC, and other efforts that we've been able to undertake some very collaborative efforts, including our Defender Offender Management Center. We call it the DOMC, which is a cooperation, coordination, and collaboration between the court system, the Lane County Sheriff's Office, and parole and probation. Formerly, each one was doing the same tasks in the same place at different times, and we now work together collaboratively in the same office located at the Lane County Jail at a tremendous savings to the taxpayers, and the collaboration has reaped many, many benefits in our ability to work together to provide greater levels of public safety for the citizens of our county. So, thank you.
Thank you, Judge Bearden. Are there any questions? Representative Krieger.
Yeah, on the staff measure summary, it says that ORS 423-560 requires each county to convene a local public safety coordinating council. So the first question is, do they all have them, all the counties, do you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, in theory, all counties would have one. It's my understanding that that there are from time to time instances, and maybe even a current example, where they have lapsed and they don't meet.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
And then you go back up to the top. It says to be eligible, local public coordinating council must be in existence on the effective date of this act. Why would we exclude some county that then didn't have one when this act goes into effect and they want to start one up and participate in it? Why would you kick them out?
I think that's an excellent point, and I'd be happy to work with anyone to develop an appropriate amendment.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Judge, for coming a long way to present to us today.
Thank you, members of the committee.
We have Paul Snyder signed up on both bills.
3251. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. First of all, we applaud the goals behind both these bills and the purposes for which Representative Nathanson has introduced them. We've worked with her a little bit in trying to identify some concerns, and I think she understands what they are. We have no position on either one of these bills. As to House Bill 3251, however, I'd like to mention that in 1995, three important things happened. Senate Bill 1145 was passed, creating the new relationship between the counties and the state involving community corrections. The Oregon Youth Authority was created, and the LIPSICs were created. The thing that is of concern to us is that at the moment, at least in terms of budget developments, there are some shortfalls likely to occur within the Youth Authority budget, community corrections budget, There's no funding proposed right now for deputy district attorneys, and of course everybody knows about the state police budget. The concern that we have with House Bill 3251 is simply this. We think it's imperative that base budgets be funded first. And the appropriation in this bill is modest. It's only $1 million, but nonetheless, we have concerns about where the funds would come from, and we believe that base budgets should come before additional ones. And that's our biggest concern with respect to House Bill 3251. Otherwise, we think it's a great idea. As to House Bill 3369, we also have no position, but a couple of concerns, one of which has to do with the fact that the Lipsticks, as Representative Nathanson testified already, there are no staffing funds available for any of them. And the counties pick up the costs of staffing these Lipsticks. And different counties have got different levels of resources that they can devote to this. And although I understand, I believe Representative Nathanson has no purpose of creating any additional burden on counties, nonetheless, this House Bill 3369 does create new mandates on the Lipsticks. It's not clear. I believe that from what Representative Nathanson testified to, that closing the loop is basically to say when you've recommended something that comes out of the Lipstick, there should be some indication as to what happened to it. And the indication of an annual report may not be costly either. It's a question of whether the devil being in the detail where that goes. As to the identification or filling of vacancies, there's only one subsection. I think it's on page 1, lines 23 to 25, where the county governing body is really the appointing authority. And as to those positions, virtually all except one are filled by virtue of the nature of the office. So I don't think there would be a problem with identifying a county commissioner, a juvenile department director, a health director, a mental health director. The only one that's left is the lay citizen, and from what I've been told, the problem there is that sometimes it's hard to find somebody who's both qualified and interested to take this position. And that's the difficulty with respect to that issue. We've worked with Representative Nathanson a little bit, and I believe that she may be open to some possible ways to address that issue. Simply, one might be to say when you find somebody who's qualified and interested, or extend the deadline, or both those things. But we'd be glad to work with her on these as well. And I just want to emphasize one more time that the purposes behind these bills are laudable, and we endorse all of the purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Snyder. I heard from my county, Washington County, the same concerns that you raised, and I wondered if you have a sense of whether there's problems in the Lipsticks in more counties other than more than other counties, and if so, could you let us know where the problems seem to be, if you have that knowledge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think it varies from place to place, and I don't have firsthand knowledge one county to the next as to where it's more problematic than others. I can tell you when we looked at these bills, we had a discussion in our steering committee, and I remember one county commissioner saying, the youth authority and the state police who got positions on the Lipstick? Never knew that. So it's maybe a matter of, you know, that was just one example. I remember when Senate Bill 1145 passed, the state police were very deeply involved, and they actually did reports statewide as to what occurred in the Lipsticks. I haven't seen those reports for a number of years, and I imagine it's just a matter of staffing level that causes the problem there.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you.
We have Ann Christian signed up.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ann Christian with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here today on behalf of the association to support House Bill 3251, and we're taking no position on House Bill 3369.
Public defense and defense attorneys are required members of the local public safety coordinating councils, and I would agree based, and this is not firsthand knowledge, but based on what I hear, that there are some counties like Lane County and I believe Multnomah County where those councils operate so collaborative and so effectively that they are models for the rest of the state. I also have heard that there is difficulty in the mid-size and the smaller counties with regard to staffing, and that's an issue that goes back, as Mr. Snyder indicated, back to 1995. Lane County, I have had some experience working with in a former position I held, and I would say that the idea of having these grants available to those counties who really engage in what the purpose of the local public safety coordinating councils, it was called an incentive fund by the representative, and I just find that so laudable. And in the scheme of things, I think it would be money well spent, not only in the model counties, but in those counties that want to work, where the players do want to work collaboratively, but due to resource issues, they're unable to launch projects, if you will. So with that, thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Christian? Thank you very much. Anna Peterson.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee. I'm Anna Peterson. I wear several hats. I am a member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I am the past co-chair of the statewide LPSC coordinating steering committee. I still serve on that committee. And I'm a member, excuse my allergies, I'm a member of the Marion County Public Safety Coordinating Council. So I come to you to talk in support of these bills from several different perspectives. In my own LPSC, I have certainly seen how the fabric of the departments, the nonprofits, then the individuals are woven together to address public safety issues and needs. The LPSC process provides that opportunity for collaboration, for cooperation, for coordination, and it certainly has strengthened the public safety response in the Marion County area. In terms of the statewide public safety coordinating councils, there is now this voluntary collaboration among public safety coordinating councils so that we can work on issues that are common to all counties or many counties. We share research, ideas, and methods, and we are just now receiving registration for our third statewide LPSC conference. These conferences have been held in the last 2 years and then this coming year so that we can bring together people who are working on various public safety issues. Attendance is about 75 to 100 people. I should tell you that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission has not taken a stand on these issues, on these two bills, because we've not had time yet to discuss those as a council. And the LPSC Coordinating Committee has considered these two bills and is in favor of these bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Are there any questions? And that concludes all the people who are signed up on both of these bills. So I'm going to close the public hearings on both 3251 and 3369. Committee members, we have one more item on our agenda, which is a work session on House Bill 2448, which has been rolled over from last week because we couldn't get to it due to the length of our agenda. So we'll have Council Kalmanson remind us what's going on with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2448 establishes a 4-year statute of limitations in product liability or negligence actions for injuries and a 6-year statute of limitations in actions for death when the claim is based on the use of a COX-2 inhibitor. Put differently, this would extend the statute of limitations for the Vioxx claims and similar lawsuits. Just to remind you of the background of this case, In 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court held that there was no discovery rule in product liability actions. The difference between a discovery rule and a non-discovery rule depends on when the statute of limitations begins to run, whether it runs when you are first injured or when you first discover the injury. The legislature then enacted a discovery rule in Oregon, but in doing so only made it prospective, so only applying from the date of the statute, which was January 1st, 2004, forward. So what HB 2448 would do by making a longer statute of limitations in these Vioxx claims, it would essentially fill the gap between when the Supreme Court decided the case, finding that there was no discovery rule, and from when the Oregon legislature enacted a discovery rule in Oregon. So for that essentially three-year period, those claims would be revived. So that is HB 2448.
Thank you, counsel. So this is an issue that's come back to the Judiciary Committee and it originally surfaced in the committee in the 2003 session that Representative Barker and I served on, and a fix was put in place, but it was one that applied only to injuries sustained after the effective date of the Act, and so the effect of this change would be to take back to those claims where the injury arose before that point. To make it possible for people to come in and put their case on. It doesn't mean that necessarily their case has merit, but it means that they're not precluded by a statute of limitations from bringing their case forward. And, counsel, as I see understand this, there's no amendments to this bill, so it's the bill as originally introduced that's before us. Is that right?
Right.
Representative Wisnett.
I think we're all concerned, and we've talked about this for some time. We're, you know, sympathetic to the people, but as a non-lawyer here, I thought our approaches to 2909 would help these people to an extent.
Actually, the issue on 2909 is that we've been hearing them together, but it's a different issue, and I think counsel can explain that to us.
Right. 2909 deals only with statutes of ultimate repose, not statutes of limitations. So what 2909 would do, at least the original bill, would say that there's no more statute of ultimate repose in Oregon. The difference between the two, a statute of ultimate repose operates like a statute of limitations in that it cuts off claims based on a period of time, but the difference is a statute of limitations begins to run when somebody was injured, and a statute of ultimate repose begins to run when something else happens, such as when you first purchased the product. So if you're talking about product liability based on a tractor, a statute of ultimate repose would run on the day that you first purchased that tractor. But if it was a statute of limitations case, it would run on the day that something happened that injured you, or at least when you first discovered that injury. So 2909 wouldn't help the people whose statute of limitations have run already.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw this as a narrow bill designed to address what I perceive as a sort of injustice to the people who happened to be taking Vioxx during that window of time between the court decision and the date that was in the fix to that court decision where they eliminated the discovery provision. I was especially taken by Mr. Moulton's testimony, who came, and he's from Eugene, and talked about how he had taken Vioxx, and he's in that window of time, and he said, as a Republican, I can understand certain pro-business stances taken to create economic development in the state, but this issue is not one of those stances. Media coverage and preliminary investigations are uncovering a pattern of suppression and deceit by Merck and others that are not business practices I want my state legislature to protect. And whether that's true or not, I think that he and people like Mr. Kirkwood deserve their day in court. And I have absolutely no doubt that the pharmaceutical companies will assert every defense that they have, whether it be that the medical problems were caused by something else or that there was some other defense that they may have. But it seems to me that, you know, when we take the Pledge of Allegiance and say injustice for all, that there's a group of people who don't get their day in court, and that strikes me as an unfairness, and so that's why I'm going to support the bill.
Further discussion? Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Can you or perhaps council give us some information about other areas where we have such a narrow product category that we do some specific legislation to capture in addition to what this bill might provide.
Council? I know that there are, thank you, Representative Flores, I know there are, in the statute of repose area, the legislature has carved out certain products, like I think asbestos products might be carved out, and I think maybe like breast implants, I think in Oregon is also carved out. I don't know off the top of my head whether there are similar carve outs for statute of limitations, but it's, I could actually look really fast and see if something pops up for me, but I know.
Sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
And I also heard Council Taylor mention side saddle gas tanks was one where there was a carve-out also.
For statutes about ultimate repose.
Bill, do you know if it's a statute of repose or limitations for...
I think I heard that discussion.
That was repose. Okay, so that would be repose as well. So, again, I'm not sure...
But we're talking about limitations, as you made clear, in the statute of limitations... as distinguished from the statute of ultimate repose.
That's correct. Right. So I the short answer is I'm not sure for the statute of limitations area, but certainly statute of repose, there have been carve-outs for specific products. So.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought about that question, too, Representative Flores, but then I concluded that this is a sort of unusual situation because of the timing of the court decision and the legislative fix that ended up not being retroactive, so that there's a group of people in that window of time without a remedy. Because typically a statute of limitations in this kind of case has to do with when they knew or should have known, but because the drug wasn't recalled until 2004, and that's when the information became available that there was a connection between these strokes and heart attacks and the medication, that's when should have discovered would take effect. So it doesn't surprise me that there wouldn't be very many situations, because it's unusual that you'd have a court decision that took away the discovery and then reinstatement of the discovery, which is the general rule in this type of case, without being retrospective. So it doesn't surprise me if there weren't any, because it's not a typical situation.
I said, Krieger, did you have a comment?
Well, just that we've got a bill. And it talks about -2 amendments and -5 amendments.
Oh, that's for the other one.
That's for the other one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's 2909.
2909.
All right. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, this bill, no amendments have been offered to it. And this bill was in the legislature last session, but didn't move through the process. So it's back to us, I think, in essentially the same form it was in.
One more comment, I'm sorry. It's really an anomaly, I think, in this situation that we're left with a group. There's a group of people, and I think one of the attorneys, I think, testified that maybe 50 people would fall within that window.
So council and chair, the Oregon, because we passed that law, we created this, you know, this period that people cannot seek a trial, and other states did not. So with other states... are not in the same situation. We're unique in that.
Well, we're unique in that we are by court decision lost the discovery rule, and which is the general rule is you don't have your statute of limitations start to run until you've discovered that you've been injured. The Gladhart case took that away, and the legislature provided it in 2003, but in so doing, it didn't apply to injuries that had already occurred before that the effective date of that enactment. So it was an incomplete fix on the problem that arose from Gladhart.
Mr. Chair, so what this bill envisions is a four-year discovery rule that only applies in this specific instance and no other product liability case.
It is a product-specific fix here, and it is product-specific, and as a general matter, it's not a great public policy to be narrowing it down, but it also limits the potential for unintended consequences as across other situations that may have occurred.
Well, I think as we ponder that, and once again, yes, I am very sympathetic to those 50 or so that slipped through that particular crack as a result of the court decision, But if we're going to do a product-specific piece of legislation in this regard, that opens the door to a whole lot of product-specific pieces of legislation moving forward at down the road and other points in time. I think we need to contemplate that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the record, I too have problems with this bill and can't support it at this time.
Okay. Any other comments?
Just, I don't like carve-outs. However, Representative Bonamici in this case and in other conversations has convinced me that to support this particular bill. I do so somewhat reluctantly for the reasons that have been mentioned by others. But the few people that are involved here should get their day in court, and they may or may not prevail, but that would, you know, that's up to them presenting the correct evidence and so on. So.
Any further discussion? Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2448 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2448 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
No.
Representative Cobb?
No.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
No.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Motion does not carry, so we do not moving out House Bill 2448. That concludes the work session on House Bill 2448 and our agenda for today. Thank you very much, committee. We're adjourned.